So then we come to the third point, or the second point. Understanding, the ultimate understanding in which the truths are inseparable. In the mind's ultimate nature, the true truths are inseparable. The application of the true truths in the single nature of the mind is nothing more than a provisional use of labels or terminology. So because you know the when you talk about two truths, you know, we're talking about the same thing, you know, same mind, the nature of the mind. So when you talk about the two truths, we're just talking about from the two ways of seeing it, not about two things. So therefore it's just two different labels, two different aspects, or you know, two different terminologies. There's no ordinary mind within the ground or absolute space of reality. So there is no basis upon which the truths could be applied. Also, you know, what says here, the yi chu ji yin la sem me pi denpa nyi chi do yi ma ri. Nribi sun ji ji gomba la sem me pi denpa nyi chi do si me. Chibi sen chen ji sen yi sa tong da la yung nyu zung me te. Ipa sa tong da nem pi denpa nyi yi me te do par sha wo si. So what he's saying here is that there is nothing called, in the Dharmata or in the nature, absolute nature or absolute reality, you can't find a concrete thing of anything that you can kind of look at and hold on to. So therefore, there's nothing there that we call, you can divide it into two. And also, at the basis of the, there's no two at the basis of the way the mind is, there's no two at the time when you become enlightened. So therefore, you know, the when you talk about two truths, it's only talking about from the our perspective of understanding and not understanding, or seeing and not seeing. Even in the clarity and emptiness, which is the nature of the minds of confused sentient beings, we cannot find this distinction, because there's only clear awareness is emptiness. This is why we must realize how the two truths are inseparable. So this is all talking about, you know, there are lots of teachings, especially in the third turning. where it says, you know, there is no two truths, there's only one truth. There the two truths become inseparable. There's no two truths. Two truths are formulated in order, you know, from the point of view of kind of samsaric being. Then, you know, we have a certain experience, the way we experience it. So therefore, that is in one point, in one side, in one way, it's true, because that's exactly how we experience it and how it is at that level of being. And then there is, if you look into the nature of it, you see the true nature of it, the way it really is, then you have a different way of looking at it, or different way of seeing it, from that point of view, not from the way things are, but not only from the way things are perceived, we define the two truths. So therefore, in real sense, there is no two truths. There is no two truths also because ultimate truth is, as we have said in the beginning, understanding the nature or deep way how the relative truth actually is, and actually how to understand how relative the experience of the mind or experience of the things that we experience is. Is so relative. It's nothing but a relatively experienced. When we understand that, then we understand the ultimate truth. So therefore, actually there is no two truths. Even so, because the inseparability of the two truths can only be realized once we have understood the characteristic of each individually, there's still a purpose to making the twofold division. I think we explained it more or less about this, because the two truths are divided, or two truths are presented, or the nature of things are presented within two truths, not because it is like that, the fact is like that, but because it's the to kind of suit to the different perceptions. To say that there is one way of seeing for us, and what the way we see or the way we experience is not necessarily the way it actually is. So therefore, there is one that we experience as relative and relatively true, and then there is something that you really understand it deeply and experience it completely, and then your way of experiencing changes. So therefore there is another level of experience. So that's why two truths. In this way, then it says, the non-conceptual simplicity, that's the natural condition of what is to be known, merges indivisibly with the non-conceptual simplicity of the natural condition of mind. What does this mean? Tata heji nilu, tetar heji nilu tujra to, nilu tujra ni, heji nilu tujra tans, nilu tujra ni, yirme rochi din rite. Te chudun gongza ge, tong zang na, shenong gu chud tanje, yirme tajay chubha tanje to tani. Nrima shenji nanga tabun, tongjan, tongje me, tojja, tojje me, pizza je, tohin tongwa na, Shichi Malupi Toba Yenos. I think maybe I should read the whole paragraph before I can understand. In this way, the non-conceptual simplicity, that's the natural condition of what is to be known, merges indivisibly with the non-conceptual simplicity of the natural condition of mind. The non-conceptual simplicity, that's the natural condition of what is to be known.
I can make a correction. Okay. That is the natural condition of knowable phenomena, let's say, because we used phenomena before, merges indivisibly with the non-conceptual simplicity of the natural condition of mind.
Within this experience, which is devoid of any notion of an individual self or phenomena identity, all outer and inner phenomena are seen to be like uncreated space, free from any kind of conceptual construct, such as existing, not existing, being permanent or nothingness, and so on. And yet the experience is beyond the duality of something seen and one who sees, or something realized and one who realizes. Therefore it is perfect, unmistaken realization. Yeah. Understood, no? No? Even that simple? I think the main thing what is saying here is that when one understands first, that the phenomena, all the phenomena, I think we talked about sheja, that anything knowable. When you look at it, it's its true nature is, emptiness and appearance, and there's nothing kind of solid, nothing totally kind of existing on its own, but arising and like flowing. But even you say that it is arising and it is, it's just like appearance and emptiness. But when you say appearance and emptiness, it's the, who is saying it's appearance and emptiness? It's a experience. It's the experience. It's the experience of the mind. But then the mind itself is also like that. So the mind itself is also something that is emptiness. And emptiness and clarity, there is nothing there. Saying yes or no, or existing, non-existing, itself. So therefore, when this comes together, when this, you know, then there's no, you know, there's nothing which kind of imputes things as existing or not existing. You know, all this existing, not existing, permanent, impermanent, all this kind of, you know, different kind of what can you say? Concepts. These are all just concepts. So therefore, you can't really find anything there to kind of, what can you say? To present this kind of constructions, or there's nothing to present this kind of things. So therefore, it's also, you know, like it's said here, it's like a space. When you say space, you know, or the sky, you say, I've seen the sky. Have you seen the sky? Who has seen the sky? But we are not talking about cloud here. Yeah? So we say that, oh, I've seen the sky. But there's, what is sky? I mean, there's nothing there to see. Yeah? Sky is not there, no? What is sky? So when you know, when there is, you know, when I say I've seen the sky, of course we all say, oh yeah, I've seen the sky also. And today it's blue and it's all this and all that, and you know, but actually, who can see the sky? Because sky is not there. Yeah. So therefore, you know, to say that I've seen the nature of mind is also a little bit like that. You know, there is nothing to see because there is nothing there to see. You know, so if you say I've seen the nature of mind, you must be lying. Yeah. So therefore, any description of the sky you make, it's not really the description of the sky. So therefore, you know, it's the same way when when we give the different identifications, you know, like it's existing or not existing, or is it permanent or not permanent, or is there or not there, or all these things is a little bit, is just concepts in a way, out of context in a way. So therefore there is no kind of, you know, therefore it's very, very, you know, there is nothing to see. And that's why, you know, Mintong Wan Tong Wan Chenpo. Sometimes, you know, it is said, the greatest seeing is not seeing. Or there's nothing to see. Because actually there's, you know, there's what you try to see or what's there to be seen or what is exactly the way is a little bit like that. There is no, you know, it's very, very strange kind of a thing. You can't say there is no space. Because there is space. But you can't say the space is there. Also, because there is nothing. Space is not nothing. So in the same way, you know, you can't say that there is no mind, but there's mind, but there's nothing there either. You know? So, therefore sometimes, you know, we say that soso rangiri parshava. It is something that that can be experienced through wisdom, through to meditation, through experience. And it is, the seeing is not really a seeing. Seeing is understanding deeply that there's nothing to be seen and no one to see it. So therefore, there's nothing to struggle about. So you can totally be. That's why all these things are difficult to translate. difficult to translate because translation is words. Any kind of presentation, any kind of words you use, any kind of signs you use, because words are actually symbols. Words are symbols of sound. No? There's no really meaning there. The meaning is what we put there, we attach meaning. Yeah? If I say what? What does that mean? It means something. You know, Africans talk about, you know, like that. Yeah? Oh, yes, he's saying something very interesting. So it's all, you know, kind of symbols of sound that then we give meaning to it, and then we understand, you know. We are very intelligent, actually, really intelligent, yeah, clever to make, and making so many languages, you know, we can go crazy, especially Europe. You must be crazy. You know, 5 minutes you go and there's another language. A totally different one, you know. You can't even pronounce them, some of, especially French one, you know. There's so many vowels, you know. Yeah, this is a kind of 10 different O's. Anyway, that's besides the point. But I was saying something, yes. So therefore, you know, so the therefore it's nothing that we can really express. And any expression is, you know, they say, is like pointing to the moon. Pointing to the moon, how do I pointing to the moon? I say, oh, there is the moon, you know. And then you look at the flick of my finger and say, oh, where is the moon? Isn't it? So moon is not here. Moon is, you know, moon is like thousands and thousands of, you know, kilometers away. So, you know, this is just symbolic, So if we don't know how to go beyond the finger, we never see the see the moon, no? So therefore, in the same way, we need to go beyond the words to be able to see, you know, exactly what it means. And that's why sometimes it's very difficult. So, that's why it is said here, within this experience, which is devoid of any notion of an individual self or phenomenal identity, all outer and inner phenomena are seen to be like uncreated space, free from any kind of conceptual construct such as existing, not existing, being permanent or nothingness and so on. And yet the experience is beyond the duality of something seen and one who sees, or something realized and one who realizes. Therefore it's perfect, unmistaken realization. So the perfect, unmistaken realization needs to go beyond that, these kind of categories, and have to be totally free. And that's why it is, you know, in the Madhyamika philosophy, like in the Prasangika especially, that's why it is presented in this negative way. Kind of cutting out all the possibilities of grasping. Any kind of ways of holding on to something, any kind of you present something, any kind of posits, you kind of cut, and then you know, you get crazy. This, no. This, no. This, no. And that's exactly what it's aiming at. You know? Because you kind of come to understand that any way of holding on to anything is not right, because it's not the way. So therefore, then you kind of come to some understanding that there's nothing to hold on to. So when you cannot hold on to, or you don't hold on to anything, you just totally be. And the be is not the, you know, our habitual way of being natural, but what we call the primordial way of being natural, completely natural, totally open, and totally, you know, free from any kind of grasping, then that's it. That can be the nearer to the way the things are, the mind is, everything is, because that's the way you are. So, you know, in a way, I think we are not trying to find out what is it. I think this we mentioned before also, but we are trying to find out how to be. How to be free from being caught and therefore get into some kind of a struggle, problem, you know. Difficulties, aversion, attachment, running after. That's why, you know, always it is said, the most important thing to learn is how to free. Bhatta Rinpoche says again and again, maybe not really here in this text, but generally says, you know, the most important thing to know is to look how to liberate yourself. And this is now becoming very important in this way. Because if you can understand this or deeply experience this, then we know how to liberate, because, you know, whatever experiences arises, whatever experiences and different kind of manifestations, or you can say the way your mind is kind of manifesting itself, if we know that these are just, you know, is a kind of momentary manifestations, and it kind of goes on, but actually, you know, you don't have to kind of hold on to anything, because there's nothing you can really hold on to. Then you learn, you know, how to let be, and that time, then this you know, the emotions and kind of habitual tendencies, because habitual tendencies are created by the emotions. So then we don't need to, you know, need to hang on or grasp so much on these emotions. And if that becomes possible, then, you know, it is self-liberated, like what we say is writing on the water, you know. They talk about like writing on stone, you know, inscribing on the stone, writing on the sand, writing on the water. At this moment, whatever happens to us is like inscribed on the stone, you know, that something happened to me, or you know, the way I think, or the way I feel, you know, then it's like inscribed on stone. 1,000 years, it's still there, you know, because I'm really much there, he's really much there, he's done that to me. When that becomes a little bit less, then it says it becomes like on sand. You know, you can write it on sand, it's very much there, but then a wave comes, at least two, then it kind of goes away. Yeah. But then we become really good at it. We see it very clearly, and then we can be in such a way that all this emotions, thoughts, and experiences is writing on water. You just write it, but as soon as you write it, it's not there, it's gone. So this is the understanding, and I think this has to be understood in context with this, you know. Seeing this kind of thing is important because of that. How it does to our way of experiencing, you know. Because the whole thing about Buddhism, whole thing about Dharma practice, about that, you know, there's nothing else, on how I can experience in a way that wouldn't, you know, make me suffer and, you know, painful and things like that, but completely free and joyful and peace, whatever may be happening to me or around me and things like that. So when I learn about that, then I can also help others to learn about that. So therefore, you know, this becomes important, and that's why then the next section is about the teaching on how to put this into practice. This understanding or this view, how to use it, how to put it into our actual experience. Now this section has two parts. The direct practice for those with the sharpest faculties. And then the gradual practice for those with the dull faculties. So, who are you? You know, sharp faculties and dull faculties is not about intelligent. It's not talking about intelligent. Sometimes people can be very intelligent. It's not, you know, it's sometimes worse because they have too many things to grasp, too many concepts and too many, you know. And also sometimes, not necessarily the most scholarly is the also the sharpest, you know. Here, sharp and dull is a different kind of sharp and dull. It's a different kind of sharp and dull. Maybe it's there. Let us go through. Those who have gathered the two accumulations in the past and who have profoundly good karma and good fortune can gain realization merely by receiving instructions on the two truths. So this sharpness and these things is about this, you know. How much how much wisdom and compassion you have accumulated before. And also good karma and good fortune, that is to do with the same thing. You know, if you have accumulated more wisdom and more compassion, then you have more good karma and good fortune. That's the same thing. Now, that's why, you know, it is always said that this kind of realization of the truth or the nature of the mind or the reality does not depend on how clever you are. It depends on, you know, sometimes they say something that has to be, sometimes people say it has a lot to do with devotion, for instance. Sometimes they say that devotion has a lot to do with it. Or you know, sometimes they say like this, like, nature of mind cannot be understood through intellectual exercises, but through devotion. Devotion is not only like being very faithful and kind of, you know, not only kind of, what do you call it, good follower kind of faithful, you know. But inspired. Inspired and, you know, that can touch the core of your heart, you know, an experiential thing. Not here, thinking, but here, you know, like, that's why sometimes people talk about mind-to-mind transmission. Or maybe you can better call it heart-to-heart transmission. So therefore, you know, somebody who has done lots of, you know, positive deeds in the past and done lots of, like, have lots of compassion, for instance, bodhisattva's attitude, bodhicitta, is more likely to experience this than who is very sharp and clever and things like that. Yeah. That's why, you know, you spend so much time on Gendo. Yeah, it's like that, you know. Of course, in some ways, a study is also considered, you know, accumulation, because it's accumulating wisdom, yeah. Accumulation wisdom. You know, we talk about two accumulations. You know, two accumulations is important. No, accumulation of merit and accumulation of wisdom, we call it. Many people have difficulties with this word merit. They always see a medal. So lots of medals. But this word merit, I don't know how it came to be translated. Maybe the real word meaning is okay. It's just the, you know, association afterwards, I think, is the problem. is, you know, doing good things, you know, positive things of body, speech, and mind. Inspired by compassion, love, you know. The more you are doing that, the more our kind of defilements are kind of cleared or thinner. And so therefore, you know, then it becomes easier to experience that. I think you know the story of Asanga. I think you know the story of Asanga, where, you know, he did this meditation for retreat for, I think, 12 years. He didn't even have a dream, a good dream. And then he saw this dog, and then he became really moved and totally, you know, compassionate. And then immediately he saw the Maitreya Buddha. So this is an example. This is a very important example, because that's accumulation, you know. Merit, accumulation of merit is that, you know. It's not necessarily doing something with, you know, just work, but accumulation of doing again and again. Accumulation is doing again and again of positive deeds, so that your negative kind of habitual tendencies becomes a little bit thinner. So then you have the more kind of able to see through. So that is clarity. That is what we call as the sharp faculties. So the four sharper faculties, then it says that somebody can just give you introduction, and then you just understand and, you know, experience. Like Buddha Sakyamuni, when he first taught the five disciples, you know, five first disciples, and he gave the same teaching, Four Noble Truths. And the one of them, who was that? Kondinya, I think, Kunshya Kondinya. He immediately got the realization. You know, in one teaching, he understood and experienced, he became an arhat. And then, after some time, slowly, other four also. So then, five became arhats. And then later on, people ask, you know, why this person of all, because she can, you know, was the first one to experience this enlightenment, arhathood. And Buddha said, it's because of a karmic, you know, karmic link and a dedication. You know the story, no? You know the story? Huh? You don't know the story? It's a very simple story. I'm sure you know it, but I want to finish this text, you know, that's why. It's okay. I'll tell it very shortly, very shortly. No, I think I will not tell the story. I'll tell if there's time. Though receiving the instruction of the two paths. In this case, simply to sustain the continuity of this recognition is sufficient. So once you have this, you know, understanding or recognition, then it is sufficient to just, you know, continue that. Because otherwise you can forget. That's what they say. You can sometimes have the recognition and then, you know, it is possible to forget it if you don't keep on practicing. In their meditative equipoise, which is devoid of the duality of knowing and something known, and is beyond any notion of a self, they will meditate in a space-like way without any conceptual elaborations related to the true truths. When practicing meditation like this, there are no negative thoughts to be cleared away and no positive states of mind to be focused upon. As Lord Maitreya says, in this there is not a thing to be removed, nor the slightest thing to be added. It's looking perfectly into reality itself, and when reality is seen, complete liberation.
That means, you know, there's the defilement, what we call defilement and obscurations, is actually not being able to experience, see this, you know, understand this. That's the defilement, main defilement. So when you actually understand this, there's nothing to be cleared. And also, all the qualities of the Buddha are actually naturally with, you know, natural qualities of the mind, or the natural qualities of the, or, you know, what you can say, primordial nature of the mind. There's nothing to add to it, so therefore, that's Buddhahood. So therefore, it's nothing to gain, or nothing to, you know, to be taken off. It's just the seeing. Understanding, seeing, clearly experiencing the way it is enough. That's the understanding. So therefore, the main thing is to have this experience and understanding, and then just, you know, keep on practicing that, so that then that experience becomes totally, totally clear, completely clear, yeah, and get rid of all like we said before, you know, that's the medicine to clear the, you know, hair problem. Following this, in the past meditation period, in the post-meditation period, one maintains the Dharma-like experience, dream-like experience of the unity of true truths by recognizing how all that is perceived appears while lacking any true reality. At the same time, with illusory bodhicitta, love and compassion for all illusory dream-like beings who have not realized this, one gathers the two illusory accumulations and makes vast prayers of aspiration for their benefit. Now this is, you know, to say, you know, these questions people ask about, you know, if it is the nature of the thing is like that, that there's nothing, you know, kind of, the nature of beings is like that, it's illusory. And there is no kind of nothing there, totally existing, but something, everything is, you know, changing, and everything is momentary, and everything is kind of interdependent, like we talked about. Then, you know, why compassion? you don't need to be compassionate to anybody because there's no real suffering. You know, there's no real beings and there's no real suffering and there's nothing. So what is... So therefore it says that whether there's real beings or not real beings, there's real suffering for them. So therefore, you know, it is like you need to have the illusory bodhicitta and love and compassion for all illusory dreamlike beings who have not realized this. And thereby we need to accumulate the two illusory accumulations and max vast prayers and aspirations for their benefit. So therefore, you know, this understanding, you know, understanding of the emptiness has to go very together with the karma. And this is, I think, an important thing to understand, because it's lots of danger. There's lots of danger that when we talk about the emptiness and things like that, then people kind of become more like nihilistic. Oh, there's nothing. You know. There's no me, there's no you, there's no real being, there's no... So what is it? There's nothing. You know. I'm free. I'm not really free like that, you know. But so... But, you know, what it's saying is that the way things are so, you know, so interdependent, so relative, transit, that there is nothing really existing on its own. But because there's nothing existing on its own, therefore it's all very delicately balanced. That's all, anything can make a big effect. So therefore any action I make can have a big effect on me and as well on others. You know? So therefore, the more we understand the emptiness, the more we understand how important the karma is. Because everything is karma. How things appear is karma. It's very, very, you know, it's very delicate. It's tender, you know. It's very, what can you say, subtle, it's very quick, you know, effect is very strong. So therefore, you know, how I experience myself is because of all this, you know, how I see things, how I understand, how I do things with my body, speech and mind. That creates all the causes and conditions, and so therefore next moment how I am is created by my actions. And in the same way, how I affect other people is also very much, you know, how I am, how I do, what I... And how we affect the whole world is also very, you know, it's not that, you know, every action that we do, even thoughts have, you know, effects, and therefore, you know, the reality we experience, the illusory reality that we experience is created by actions. So therefore, what kind of illusory reaction, you know, experience we experience is very much based on our way of, you know, being and our way of acting and our way of doing with our participation mind and with all the actions that. That's why, you know, it is often said, this is very important, that people who understand, you know, who have studied like two truths, emptiness, and things like that, and if they really understood deeply, they become really careful about karma. They become really convinced about karma. And really, you know, what can you say, mindful about karma. And those who studied and didn't understand really very well, then they become loose about this. And they kind of careless about karma. And, you know, and therefore, sometimes it is said that how well you understood the emptiness can be judged by how careful you are about karma. Because the more you become clear about the effect of the karma, the more you can see you have understood about the nature of the emptiness. So therefore, you know, this connection between the karma and emptiness is extremely important and very crucial. Because if this kind of is not clearly understood, then you can go totally the wrong way, you know. And that's the real reason why, like, teachings like Dzogchen and things like that is not given so easily. Because it is, there is sometimes a danger that you become like, you become kind of, what can you say? You don't understand this clarity, this connection, and then you become, I am Dzogchen practitioner, it doesn't matter whatever I do, you know, like, I see everything as equality, one test. And then you say something bad against you, and then you know how bad, how one test you are. You know, this is exactly what Pat Rinpoche was testing this person, you know, who said, I have no more anger anymore. You know, he wanted to know he really have anger or not. So these are the, you know, the important, very important. So that's why, you know, although, you know, the meditation and understanding and experience of this wisdom of the, you know, the truth is actually accumulation of both. You know, it's not necessarily, it's not accumulation. That is also accumulation of not only wisdom but also, you know, but merit. But basically, when we talk about the accumulation of merit, then we talk about in the Mahayana six paramitas, or the at least the first four, five paramitas, you know, is the accumulation, and then wisdom is the, and then all accumulations is to lead to the accumulation of wisdom. But wisdom accumulation is actually also accumulation of merit. This too has to be understood. Then, maybe we can stop here and Let us leave the dull faculty ones, yes, for tomorrow. I don't think there's anyone here with the dull faculties. So, any questions? Yeah? The story. What was the story? Oh, yes. Yeah. I think you know the story, but anyway, you know, it's a very common story, and it's a well-known Jataka story, you know. Because everybody wanted to know this reason why, you know, of all the people in the world, why Buddha taught these five people first. And of all these five people, one of them, the Kaundinya, became arhat first, and you know, very quickly. And Buddha said that that's because of the former kind of karmic connection. And then he told this story that it's not because of a good karmic connection, it was because of a bad karmic connection, actually. And then he told the story of this the rishi Zhepalagawa, you know, the one who pleased to practice patience. Zhepalagawa, one who is pleased to practice patience. And this one who was pleased to practice patience was meditating in a jungle, in the forest, somewhere near the Himalayas, it seems. And then there was a king around that area who wanted to hunt. And he used to come and camp in this area with all his people, you know, including queens and their retinue and his group. And then he used to go hunting on horseback and leave his woman folk back. And one of these times, you know, his ladies, the queens, went walking in the forest, you know, to pluck fruits and things, flowers and things like that. And they came across this, you know, most dignified and handsome rishi. You know, because, you know, when you practice patience, you become beautiful. You know that? Yes. And then they were very impressed, and so they made offerings to him and asked for teachings, and he was giving teachings. They used to go to see him very often. And one day, the king came back from a failed, you know, hunting. He couldn't, you know, get any, you know, good things done. And then so he came back, and it's late, and I think he was hungry, and you know, he came to the camp and there was nobody, all the queens were gone. He says, "Where are my queens?" He says, "They were all went to see this beautiful rishi up there." So he went, you know, on his horseback to this rishi's place, and he saw all his queens kind of sitting around him with like... So he didn't like it, I think. So he asked, you know, "What are you doing here with all my queens around?" So he says, "I'm just here, you know, I'm rishi, I'm, you know, meditating." "What are you meditating?" "I'm meditating patience. I'm the one who likes, who is pleased being patient." Then he got even more angry, and he took out his sword and started to cut his limbs. You know, he was a, what can you say, you know, kind of a king, you know, who had no, you know, what do you call that? Who have no discipline? Not naughty. while, but anyway, it doesn't matter. So he was doing this. And then the rishi said that, you know, you had, you know, you are kind of, you know, you are cutting all my limbs and things like that, and I'm dying. But I have no anger towards you. If this is correct, by the truth of that, I pray, I dedicate that when I become enlightened, you will be the first one to receive the benefit of it. And at that time, may I be able to cut off all your defilements and obscurations as you cut off my limbs now. And this is my dedication. And then he died. And of course, you know, this king went into hell and deeper hell and all sorts of other places, you know, and whatever he had to get with this bad karma and things like that. But at the end, when then Sakyamuni Buddha became Buddha, he was the first one to be, you know, to be liberated. So that's the story he told, Buddha told. Because of that, he became the first one. So association, that's why it is always said that association with bodhisattvas, or Buddhas or bodhisattvas, are always good, even if in the wrong way, you know. Of course, the wrong way is very bad. If you bad association is very bad for the, you know, because it's very negative. You know, you get, but in the long run, you know, it's better than having no association at all. You know, so that's the kind of that's the story.
Rinpoche, can you give some advice on how to maintain this view through the time of our death and in the appearances of the bardos?
Now the thing is, the first is of course the practice in this life, no? The more we practice now, the more we, you know, familiarize ourselves now, the more it is said that we'll be more kind of more easy at the time of bardo. And if it is, we are really good at this, if we do really very well now, then, you know, you don't have to wait for the pardo. You know, it's you get liberated before pardo. But they say that the pardo is sometimes easier. Sometimes the pardo time is easier to recognize or experience than now. If we have some, you know, kind of experience or some training now, then pardo time it comes much stronger, because pardo time it is said that whatever we do now or whatever, you know, kind of habitual tendencies we have now becomes much more clearer and much more stronger. You know, it becomes kind of it comes out in a more strong force. They say that our mind becomes sometimes, you know, seven times clearer or something like that. And also, during the death, or, you know, in the process of death, when this kind of experience of clear light and things like that happens, then, you know, if we have some experience now, then we, you know, we recognize it much more clearly. Then we can say, that, oh, that, what I was, you know, hearing or what the lamas were talking about was this. Yes, this is it. So therefore they say it's like the child kind of going to the lap of the mother, you know. You recognize, oh yes, this is it, you know, like, and then there is no hesitation and no kind of doubt. So becomes very, very strong. So therefore they always say that among the people who get liberated in this life, you know, who get enlightened, you can call it if you like, in this life, most of them actually do it at the time of death, they say. Yeah. So therefore the first and most important element or the most important thing to do is to practice now. But then also, you know, the teachings all the time, we talk about, you know, meditation and post-meditation, yeah? So the meditation is one thing and post-meditation is another thing. And to try to integrate into our life is the post-meditation. You know, what we call post-meditation is to bring that experience or understanding, whatever little, to our daily life. And that becomes the most important thing. And only through a post-meditation practice, they said that you really get liberated. You know. So therefore, whatever little we understand or experience, to kind of try to integrate that in our life, in daily life, is the most important thing. And this is true practice. So therefore, people who are working hard, you know, whether you are working hard in the center or working hard outside, is good to retreat. No? Because if you work and then also can integrate the understanding of the Dharma into it, then that's true practice. You know? Meditation, just meditation in the retreat is training to practice. I see it like this. Yeah. We need that, we need retreat, we need meditation, but that's more training to practice, how to practice. And real practice is in the integration, in how you do it in the life. And that, sometimes I think, do not need time. It's not about time. It's about mindfulness, discipline, you know, and awareness. It's not about time. Because it is just, you know, whatever situations going on, whatever experiences going on, whatever you are doing, whatever state of mind it is, to understand, you know, to be able to, that time, you know, use your understanding. That's the practice, no? Like when you get upset, do we need time to get upset? I have so much work, I have no time to upset. Or I'm so much to do that I don't get time to get, get worried or get hurt or get feel bad. You just do that. There's no special time needed. I have so much work that I have no time to get stressed. Then work harder. The more stress you get, the work harder. That would be the solution, no? But you don't need time, no? So therefore, we don't need time to practice also, because whenever that's happening, then you just, allow your mind to bring these understandings. So there, if you can even bring little bit of understanding, little bit of, relaxation, little bit of kind of lightness on how to see things, that changes, that affects you. So therefore, then it really transforms your life. And once, the Bardo is actually a continuation of our mind now, no? So therefore, it's nothing special too much, actually. Of course, it's a kind of difficult time, but it's same thing. I think it's like that.
I've heard this before just once, and I think you mentioned it today, and I just wanted some clarity on it. When we talk about the clarity and the luminosity of the mind, I think you said that it's an awareness and not a light, but a knowing quality. Sometimes when I hear the two luminosities or the clear light, I do have a kind of sense that it's something to do with light, but you were saying that it's more an awareness.
When we talk about the nature of mind, and then when you talk about the, the clarity or the, the emptiness, clarity, and unimpeded nature of the mind, these three things, that clarity is always to do with the knowing thing. There's the knowing quality of the mind. The clarity of the mind. When we talk about the Pardo time, when the kind of the Pardo of Dharmata, Pardo of Dharmata, and then when kind of there are different things happening at the Pardo of Dharmata. The first thing, the kind of clear light, what we talk about, clear light when in the deep level of our consciousness, the subtle of our consciousness, the most kind of subtle level of consciousness when all the kind of gross thoughts are, dissolved, the gross kind of experience is dissolved when you are in the most subtle. And that clear light, can be also at the time of deep sleep. And that is also the awareness, the kind of subtleness. But when you come out of this, then as its radiance, they say there are lots of colors and lights, and even sometimes, five lights, five colors of five wisdoms and things like that happening, and then peaceful and wrathful deities happening and things like that. This then sometimes is a little bit like light also, you know, talking of light, because that's, you know, the origin of all the, not the origin maybe you cannot say, but from the Vajrayana point of view, all the appearances, you know, all the all the forms start to, the forms are happening or creating, creation of the forms or appearance of the forms start with light and colors. So therefore it is, you know, at the time of Pada also, when we start to awaken from, then the colors appear and light, and different kind of lights and colors appear. And it is also said that the basis of all the creation, all the material, also starts with lights and colors and things like that. So those is slightly different.